having me here. It's been, you know, this is my first visit here, and it's really great. I like it a lot. So I'm going to tell you today about these things, these next to simplest quantum field theories. This is some work done with a collaborator of mine, Shailesh Lal, at HRI. There are a couple of papers this is based on. This one came out a few months ago, and this one actually came out yesterday. And it's always been, you know, my desire to put out a paper and speak about it the next day. So today is my chance. So I'm going to tell you. Let me just give you the setting of you know where all this is. And a lot of this work has been done at Perimeter, and so perhaps many of you have heard about this. But for those of you who haven't, I'll just give you a quick setting of what this is about. So you know, basically, over the past few years, we've learned that if you look at scattering amplitudes, and not correlation functions, in gauge theories and in gravity, you find that these things have a lot of fascinating properties. Okay. And now there are many reasons these properties are interesting. One very mundane reason these properties are interesting is that you know you can use them to do calculations at the LHC. So it's actually you know if you just want to do quantum field theory calculations at the LHC, standard model calculations, these things are very efficient. But that's one reason these techniques are useful and everyone should be interested in them. There's another reason, which is the reason I'm interested in them, and which is the fact that, you know, we hope that this will give us, in some sense, a fresh perspective on quantum field theory itself. That's a very ambitious hope, but in some sense, that's the hope of the program. Okay. Now, the setting here is that a lot of this work on S-matrix elements and amplitudes has focused on n equal to 4 super Young-Mills, and to some extent on n equal to 8 supergravity. And these theories seem to have the simplest amplitudes, despite having a very complicated Lagrangian. They're natural candidates to study first. But then, you know, perhaps it's true that these are the simplest quantum field theories. But, you know, at least to me, it wouldn't be so much fun if this program stopped after finding the S matrix of planar n equal to 4 superangles. Okay. And so in some sense, if this entire way of looking at quantum field theories is any use, then you want to ask the question of what are the next to simplest quantum field theories, or what are the almost simple quantum field theories, or as an Indo would say. Okay. So and the question is, can you find other theories that have amplitudes which are simple, that are much simpler than you would naively expect from the Lagrangian, which do see cancellations in their S matrix elements, but which are not quite as simple as n equal to 4 super Young-Mills. Okay. And the question is, can you generalize these S matrix techniques to these amplitudes? So in some sense, that's the question, that's the setting, and that's the motivation of my talk. Okay, so what am I going to do? Let me just give you a brief summary of what I'm going to say. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to scan gauge theories coupled to matter. So instead of looking at n equal to 4 super Young-Mills, I'll look at gauge theories coupled to matter in arbitrary representations, both supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric, and ask what are the conditions for one-loop amplitudes to simplify. Okay. And it turns out that the condition for the S matrix to simplify can be written as a set of group theoretic constraints on these matter representations. Okay. And so I'm going to find for you a couple of theories we can solve these constraints. So there'll be two theories which we find where amplitudes or gluon amplitudes are as simple as n equal to 4 super Young-Mills. By the way, I haven't yet told you what simplicity means. I'm using the word simple many times. I haven't yet told you what I mean by simple. I'll tell you in a minute. But the idea is we're going to find two theories where gluon amplitudes are as simple as n equal to 4 Young-Mills. And we'll find a number of other theories which see simplifications to a lesser extent than n equal to 4 SYM, but they do see simplifications in their S matrix. Okay, so these are, in some sense, the next to simplest, the next to next to simplest quantum field theories. Okay, so that's roughly what I'm going to talk about. That's the setting and what I'm going to find. Okay, so let me just give you an overview of my talk. I'll keep this overview on the side so you can see what I'm going to talk about, how much more you have left. And so I'll start by doing a very quick review of these new S-matrix techniques. It's possible that many of you already know about them, and in any case, I'm not going to do a comprehensive review. I'll just talk about what I need. I'll talk about, you know, these group theoretic constraints that I said are required for the S-matrix to simplify. I haven't yet told you what these bubble and triangle coefficients are. I'll tell you what they are. But you know, roughly speaking, these one-loop amplitudes have some objects called bubbles and triangles. You can express them in terms of bubbles and triangles. And the condition for, you know, the one-loop S matrix of n equal to 4 super Young-Mills to simplify is that these bubbles and triangles should vanish, and these rational terms should vanish. So I'll tell you what are the group theoretic constraints you have for each of these terms to vanish. Now, these constraints can be written in terms of these objects called indices. Okay? So I'm going to have to tell you what these indices are. And for that, I'll take a slight detour into group theory. And then I'll tell you what these next to simplest quantum field theories are. Okay? So I'll tell you what these next to simplest quantum field theories are, the two theories I spoke about, and then other theories with various degrees of simplification. Okay? And then I'll summarize. So that's an overview of the rest of my talk. Okay? Great. Okay. So let me just tell you, start with a very quick review of these simple properties. So let me tell you about the Park-Taylor formula, not because it's particularly relevant to what I'm going to say, but because it's almost religious to, you know, invoke this at the beginning of a talk on S matrix elements. Okay, and it's also a very remarkable example of these simplifications that I'm going to talk about. Okay, so consider, a tree-level scattering amplitude, but it's a very special kind of amplitude, where, you know, two elements, two gluons have negative helicity, and everything else has positive helicity, okay? So now you might think that, okay, this amplitude is a mess, because, you know, if you have 100,000 gluons, then this amplitude comes from calculating some 100,000 point correlation function, and even at tree level, this is something that's extremely ugly, okay? But it turns out, as you know, so this is not even a surprise, that this amplitude is extremely simple, and this is actually called the Park-Taylor formula. And this amplitude can be written in terms of these spinner helicity variables, and there's this really elegant simple formula for this amplitude. Okay, so that's something very nice. This was discovered a long time ago, now almost 25 years ago, but it was the first example of, you know, these very remarkable simplifications that happen in S matrix elements. It turns out actually something very similar happens for gravity too. Okay, now my French is not too good. But there is a really remarkable formula for gravity, but alas, it's too large to fit in this little space. But if you're interested, I'll tell you what it is. But a la Fermat, I can't put it here. But there is a very remarkable simplification that happens for gravity too, and this was also discovered about a couple of years after this Park-Taylor formula. Okay. That's saying that there is a truly remarkable formula, but alas, it's too large to fit in this space. Okay, now that's it. Okay, great. So now what's new? And this is something that's very old, you know, 25 years. So what is it that's new? So what's new is one of the things that's new, and there are many things that are new, but one thing that's going to be important to me are these BCFW relations. So what are these BCFW relations? Okay. So now let's consider an endpoint gluon amplitude, which is some arbitrary amplitude, no restrictions in the helicities. And let me take two of these momenta. So this is my endpoint amplitude, tree amplitude. I chose P4 and Pn, but you could choose P1 and P5 or whatever you like, okay? And you extend these momenta while keeping them on shell. So you extend them so you take this P4 and you deform it as a function of this parameter z, where this q is some null vector. And you can see easily that this q has to have complex entries, but that's fine because there's no problem. So you deform this amplitude in this way. And you can check when you do this, if you look at the Gate boson polarization vectors for this P4 and Pn, depending on how you deform it, there are two choices of deformation you can have. Depending on that, one of the two Gate boson polarization vectors on each side grows as large z. Okay? Okay, so now you can ask, how does this amplitude behave at large z? And naively, you might think that this amplitude grows at large z. It grows at large z because, you know, your polarization vectors grow at large z, and you know, Yang-Mills has derivative interactions. So you would expect that if I took this amplitude and deformed it in this way, it would grow at large z. Okay? But it turns out this is actually not the case. And in fact, for you know, you have four possible choices of polarization for this P4 and Pn. For three out of these four polarizations, this amplitude actually dies off at large z as 1 over z. So this is something extremely surprising. But it's more than being surprising. You know, it's also something very useful. And the reason it's very useful is that the tree amplitude is a holomorphic function of z, okay? Because you don't have any logs. You're just calculating tree amplitudes. And if a holomorphic function dies off at infinity, you can reconstruct it from its poles. And these poles are also very special because the residue of these poles basically occurs when, you know, some internal line goes in shell. And so the residue is just the product of two smaller tree amplitudes. Okay? So that lets you write down these recursion relations, which schematically say, you know, if you have some endpoint amplitude, you can break it up into two parts, and you can construct it in terms of lower point amplitudes. Okay? So in fact, you can do this all the way down. Maybe it's clearer if I show it to you graphically. So you have some endpoint amplitude, and then you can write it as a product of two lower point amplitudes with some factors in the middle. Okay? And you can use this all the way to go down to all the way, you know, to the three-point amplitude. So it's a very efficient and very elegant way of constructing tree amplitudes. And you can also use this to derive this Park-Taylor formula. It's very easy to use these recursion relations to just prove the Park-Taylor formula using induction. Okay. But now, you know, you can generalize these recursion relations to other theories, such as gravity. And in fact, for gravity, these recursion relations are even more useful because perturbative gravity is a mess. DeWitt, a long time ago, more than 40 years ago, worked out, you know, just perturbative gravity. And if you just expand the Lagrangian out, you'll find there's an infinite number of interaction vertices of ever-increasing complexity. So, you know, if you just look at the four-point vertex in gravity, you find it already has 2,850 terms, and then the higher vertices have even more terms. And so here, this is an extremely efficient way to calculate gravity amplitudes by just looking at the three-point function. Okay? So these recursion relations are even more useful for gravity than they are for Yang-Mills. Now, you can also generalize them to n equal to 4 super Yang-Mills and n equal to 8 supergravity. And the reason that's not as simple as you might expect is because these nice properties about, you know, these amplitudes dying off at large Z and so on are things that hold for gluons and gravitons, but not in general for matter particles. Okay? But when you have n equal to 4 super Yang-Mills and n equal to 8 supergravity, the speciality being that all the particles there are in the same multiplet, okay, you can basically relate scattering amplitudes to scattering amplitudes of gluons. So you can use these nice properties of gluon scattering amplitudes to calculate all amplitudes in n equal to 4 Yang-Mills and n equal to 8 supergravity. And in fact, there's something which is even nicer about n equal to 4 and n equal to 8, which is that, you know, I remember I said, perhaps you didn't notice, but I said that when you looked at Yang-Mills, when you did this BCFW deformation, it worked for 3 out of 4 polarizations. And for 1 out of 4 polarizations, this amplitude wasn't well behaved at infinity. Okay? So given some amplitude and given 2 particles I want to extend, you need to choose your BCFW deformation correctly, depending on the polarizations of those particles. So you don't need to worry about this for n equal to 4 Yang-Mills. Okay, so the details of this are not very important, but the punchline is that n equal to 4 tree amplitudes are even nicer behaved in some sense than pure gauge and gravity amplitudes.
What would the
and not much else. It basically just lets you relate everything to gluons. So And the reason n equal to 4 is special because everything is in the same multiple. If you look at n equal to 1 and n equal to 2 theories, you actually have 2 representations of the Suzy algebra, which are CPT conjugate. Okay, good. Now what happens at one loop? This is what happens at tree level. So now in one loop, again, this is something that's been known for a long time. So you know, one theme that occurs here is often that you have something that's very old, you have developments that are very old, and then you have new things that supplement these developments that make them useful. Okay, so something that's been known for a very long time, from 1979, is that if you look at any one loop amplitude in any quantum field theory, okay, you can write it in 4 dimensions. You can write it in terms of you know, scalar boxes, triangles, bubbles, and rational terms. And if you think about it for a minute, you'll see that this is a very surprising statement. Because if you had, you know, a 20-point amplitude, you would in general not expect to be able to reduce it to something which has only 4 propagators, okay, to a loop integral that has only 4 propagators. Okay? But this is true. One way you can think about it is as the process of doing partial fractions, in which case this rational remainder comes about because you're working not in 4 dimensions, but in 4 plus epsilon dimensions. Okay. But what is new is that in the past couple of years, we've learned how to efficiently calculate these rational coefficients. Okay. And I'll tell you a little more about these things when I need them. But what I want you to keep in mind is that what's remarkable and what didn't have to happen, but what did happen, is that if you look at these triangle and bubble coefficients, okay, they're calculated through products of BCFW deformed tree amplitudes. Okay? So all these coefficients are calculated in terms of products of tree amplitudes, but in particular these triangle and bubble coefficients are calculated in terms of products of tree amplitudes deformed in the way I told you about a couple of minutes back. Okay, so there's this very nice relation between these S-matrix techniques at tree level and S-matrix techniques at one loop, and this didn't have to be the case, but it's true. Okay. And this will be very useful for us later. Okay. So now, what is so special about n equal to 4 Yang-Mills and n equal to 8 supergravity? So what's so special is that in general, in an arbitrary quantum field theory, you expect that, you know, all these terms will appear. You take some arbitrary amplitude in some phi to the 4 theory, and you can do this Pasarino-Weltzmann reduction, and you'll find that the amplitude has boxes, it has triangles, it has bubbles, and it has rational terms. It has everything. Okay? Now, n equal to 4 and n equal to 8 are very special in that they have only boxes. Okay, they don't have these triangles, they don't have these bubbles, and they don't have these rational terms. And so, in fact, you can reconstruct the n equal to 4 amplitude from a knowledge of its leading singularity, which is basically the coefficient of the box. Okay? And it's conjectured that this leading singularity property holds to all loops. So n equal to 4 amplitudes have the simplest possible analytic structure amplitudes can have. They're completely determined by the leading singularities. In fact, there's an all-loop conjecture by Kanihamed, Kachasso, and others, which says that, you know, if you look at some endpoint amplitude in n equal to 4 Young Wills, some total helicity n minus 2k, you can write it as a contour integral in the space of k planes in n dimensions. So there's this Grassmannian conjecture that tells you how to calculate this, but I won't talk much more about this here. Okay? But the punchline is that n equal to 4 Young Wills and n equal to 8 supergravity seem to have the simplest analytic properties that are possible, and their scattering amplitudes are determined in terms of these leading singularities, and there's some way to calculate these leading singularities. Okay, so now this is a very natural question you can ask. Are there any other amplitudes at one loop that have the same property, that can be written only in terms of these boxes that have such a simple analytic structure? Okay, so, okay, you know n equal to 4 Young Wills is very nice, but are there other amplitudes that have this property? We actually know one set of amplitudes that do have this property, and that is that if you look at multi-photon amplitudes in QED with more than 8 external photons, it turns out that they do have this property, that you can write them in terms of only boxes. Okay, this is something that was shown a couple of years ago. But we'll find a more systematic way of finding these amplitudes. We'll find some other amplitudes too. So this is the first question you can ask. Are there other amplitudes that can be written only in terms of boxes? Okay. Then you can ask, are there amplitudes which have triangles but which don't have bubbles? And then you can ask, are there other amplitudes that have rational terms or that don't have rational terms but that have maybe bubbles and triangles both? The reason I say non-supersymmetric here is because supersymmetric terms have no rational terms. Okay? But these are a natural set of questions to ask, and the question you're asking is, in some sense, are there other theories with an analytic structure as nice as n equal to 4? Are there some with an analytic structure that's nice but not as nice? And then so these are the next to simplest quantum field theories. Okay? So these are natural questions to ask. You want to explore other quantum field theories and study the analytic structure. Okay, so what am I going to do? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to study gluon amplitudes in gauge theories coupled to matter. N equal to 4 Young Wills is a particular example of that, but I'll look at more general gauge theories coupled to matter in arbitrary representations. And it will turn out that these conditions on the amplitudes can be written in terms of group theoretic constraints on these matter representations. Okay? That's something very nice, which I'll tell you more about. Furthermore, it turns out that these conditions are hierarchical. You know, if you demand that a theory has no triangles, that's the set of theories the conditions are hierarchical and the set of theories are subsets of another. So the condition for having no triangles is stronger than the condition for having no bubbles, which is stronger than the condition for having no rational term. Okay? There's a strict, or decreasing order of strength if you go about it. Okay, and now I said this before, but let me just tell you again. So we are going to find two theories where gluon amplitudes have no triangles, many theories, now you weaken the condition a little bit. Many theories where we do have triangles but have no bubbles, and we are going to find infinite class of non-supersymmetric theories that have no rational terms. Okay? So there are many such amplitudes that have SC simplifications in their S matrix that's not at all evident from the Lagrangian. Okay, great. Okay, so now this is an outline of the rest of my talk. I'm going to derive for you these constraints I talked about, then I'm going to solve them, and I'll tell you what the solutions are. Are there any questions about this background and motivation right now? Okay.
Because that's where we really have
very good control over arbitrary quantum field theories. We have nice spaces of integral coefficients you can expand things in, and so on. And higher loops.
Do you expect that it's going to be extended to higher loops?
Yeah. I mean, so that's one of the things you would of course like to do. Okay, good. So now let me talk about when you first start thinking about this problem, you think, well, you know, there's no other theory that will have amplitudes that are simple for the following simple reason. You know, n equal to 4 Young Wills, let's say you look at a gluon scattering amplitude in n equal to 4 Young Wills. So this is some one of the matter particles of n equal to 4 running about. Now you change the matter, okay? So you have a gauge theory coupled to matter in a different representation. So now if you have a 10-point amplitude, you know, you get a Feynman diagram like this, comes with a trace of t to the 10. Okay? If you have a 100-point amplitude, you get a trace of t to the 100. Okay, so naively, there is no relation between amplitudes in n equal to 4 super Young Wills and amplitudes in a gauge theory coupled to matter otherwise in other representations. Okay? So naively, if you just, at first glance, it is not at all obvious that there should be any reason why if you replace the matter content of the n equal to 4 theory, you will continue to get any simplifications in the amplitude. Okay? Okay, I said this already. But what happens is that it turns out, and this is the surprising thing that you find if you look a little more, is that these matter contributions are actually not so complicated. And this is something very surprising, and it's not something you would have guessed without the advent of these new S-matrix techniques. It turns out they're not very complicated. And in fact, if you look at, you know, these triangles and bubbles and rational terms, they're not sensitive to the entire character of the matter representation, and they're just sensitive to a few of its invariants. Okay, so, and this is going to be very, very important for us. Okay, good. So let me just tell you what the idea behind this simplification is. So the idea behind the simplification is basically that if you look at these one-loop integral coefficients, these coefficients of triangles and bubbles, they're given not in terms of just products of tree amplitudes, but in terms of products of VCFW extended tree amplitudes. Okay, so I've written that here. So if you want to calculate this bubble coefficient, you take two amplitudes, which have two scalars, because these are the two scalars that are running about in the loop, that have many gluons. Okay, so these dot, dot, dots are the external gluons. Okay, so you have the product of one amplitude in the left, one tree amplitude in the right. And the special thing about these amplitudes is that both of these are BCFW extended. Okay, so you've taken this scalar momentum and you've shifted it by some QZ, and the other momentum by another QZ. Okay, and this is what gives you this bubble coefficient. So you multiply these three amplitudes and you pick out the coefficient of Z to the zero. So these are amplitudes that involve two matter particles, where the matter particles are BCFW extended, and many gluons. And the basic idea, the reason we get these simplifications, is that under a BCFW extension, this amplitude simplifies a lot. I'll tell you in a minute. Why does it simplify? So it's actually quite easy to see why it simplifies. It simplifies, you know, there are many ways to see it simplifies, but here's the most intuitive way to see it simplifies. You know, imagine calculating a tree amplitude with two matter particles and many gluons. Okay, so all of these are some gluon lines. But now you choose this Q light cone gauge for these gluons. So you're free to choose a gauge for these gluons, for the gauge field. And you choose this, you know, you're given this QZ for the matter particle up front. You know what it is, okay? So I choose a gauge for the gauge field, which is a Q dot A zero. And in this gauge, you can immediately see what happens, okay? So there's one diagram for which you can't choose this gauge, which is when the gauge field carries a momentum that's orthogonal to Q. That's this diagram. That gives you an order of Z interaction. If you were not in this gauge, this diagram would actually give you an order 1 interaction, because you'd get an order Z term from here, an order 1 over Z term from here, and you'd get an order 1 interaction. And in general, if you were not in this gauge and you began to draw Feynman diagrams, you would find that you would get an arbitrary number of generators that would all contribute at order 1. Okay, you'd get. Okay, but in this gauge, if you try and write down more gluon-matter interactions, you find that you have to introduce more propagators, and each of those comes with a factor of 1 over Z. Okay, so if you're in this gauge and you're trying to look at the amplitude, you know, the BCFW extended amplitude of two scalars and many gluons, you find that it's very simple, because if you try and write down products of more generators, they come with further powers of Z. Okay, I can make this precise, and that's following. You know, if you look at the amplitude with two scalars, and many gluons, and these two scalars being BCFW extended, and you ask how it behaves, you find it behaves in the following way. You know, if you look at the symmetrized product of P generators, that comes with a factor of Z to the P minus 2. Okay, this Ji tells you what the colors of the scalars are. And these Cs are things that go to order 1 at large Z. Okay, so this is a very nice result. You can derive about amplitudes with two scalars and many gluons. Okay, so the term with one generator comes with a Z. The term with two generators comes with a 1. The term with three generators comes with a 1 over Z. By the way, I want to emphasize that these are symmetrized products of generators. Because if you had an arbitrary unordered product, you could use commutation relations to go down to something lower. Okay, so this is something that's well defined. You can ask, you know, what is the order, what's the rank of the symmetrized product, and you find that when you have p terms here, that comes with a factor of Z to the p minus 2. Okay, now an identical result holds for fermions. Okay, so you can do this for fermions too. If instead of scalars here you had fermions, you would find that exactly the same result holds. Okay, so BCFW extended particles of two fermions also behave simply. And in fact, in supersymmetric theory, something even nicer happens, and that is that these coefficients that I'm talking about are actually the same for scalars and for fermions. Okay, so if I did the calculation in a supersymmetric theory, then I'd find that actually these coefficients, C that I get here, they're coefficients of this sort for both the scalars and for the fermions, they're actually the same to leading order in Z. Okay, I'll come back to this in a minute. Okay, so now you can put this result together, and what you do is you want to look at the product of two tree amplitudes, and you see that if you look at the product of three tree amplitudes, where each of the two tree amplitudes behaves in the way I told you about, and you look at the z to the zero coefficient, then this bubble coefficient can at most depend on the trace of four generators. Okay, that's because your tree amplitude, each of the tree amplitudes behaves like this. And if I take two of these and I multiply them together, you can see that in the and I extract the z to the zero coefficient in the product, you'll see I'll get a t to the four. Because I can take a z from here and a 1 over z from here. I can take two of these. And I can't get anything more than a t to the four. Okay? So this is a very surprising result about bubble coefficients, which you would not guess if you didn't know about these new techniques of extracting these coefficients. It's a simple result, but it's a surprising result. Okay. Now, in supersymmetric theories, it turns out the answer is even nicer. The reason the answer is even nicer is because of what I told you about how the large Z behavior of fermion and scalar amplitudes is the same. Okay? And so, as a result, because of the minus sign in the fermion loop, of course, you find that in supersymmetric theories, even this leading trace, this t to the 4 term, cancels, and all you get is a trace of two generators. Okay? So in supersymmetric theories, these bubble coefficients are sensitive only to the trace of two generators. By the way, this omega, of course, is independent of the representation. Okay? So I'm saying if I want to calculate a bubble coefficient, I only need to calculate omega, this omega, once, and then I can do the coefficient for any representation. I can change my representation around, and that doesn't alter anything. I just need to change the trace factor. Okay, so this is, again, something that's very nice that happens in supersymmetric theories. Okay, what about triangle coefficients? So for triangle coefficients, the story is exactly the same, except that these things depend on the product of three tree amplitudes. So now each of my three tree amplitudes goes in this way, as the way I've written here, and then you can ask what happens if you multiply three of them together, and you find you can get a trace of t to the six. Right? So it's clear that if you look at non-supersymmetric theories, this trace can be a trace of t to the six. Okay? So this is, again, something that and this omega, I emphasize, is independent of R. So if I wanted to calculate some triangle coefficient in a gauge theory with matter, I need to calculate it once for one matter representation and extract these omegas, and then I know it for all matter representations. Because the dependence on the representation is completely factored out. And I want to emphasize it's really hard to get this by drawing Feynman diagrams. If you started drawing Feynman diagrams, you would never guess that triangle coefficients depended on only a finite number of traces like this. Now, for supersymmetric theories, again, things simplify, and you find that it can depend on the trace of only up to five generators. By the way, I want to say the trace of five generators is a little bit of a fake, because if you have a self-conjugate representation, this trace actually vanishes. And in general, for your, if you want your representation to be anomaly-free, you generally would like it to be self-conjugate, but you could think of representations that are not that anomaly-free and that have a fifth trace. But in general, for most cases, even this vanishes, you're left with only the fourth trace of four generators. Oh, wait, because you go down from 6 to 5. It's only the leading term that cancels. I mean, what I have here is each of these three amplitudes has terms like this, and then I multiply three of them together, and then I add the scalar and the fermion contribution. And the leading term cancels, so the t to the 6 term cancels, but the sub-leading terms remain. And the reason you get this simplification in supersymmetric theories is because of cancellation between fermions and scalars.
So the cancellation happens after?
After what? After multiplication. I mean, yeah, because otherwise there's no sense in which you're going to cancel. I mean, you want to cancel the full fermion contribution, the loop, to the full scalar contribution in the loop. Yeah. Okay, great. So this is what I said. Let me just tell you about what happens for rational terms. Now, when we first thought about these rational terms, it turned out that, we didn't have any good way of looking at them because there's no nice way of thinking of rational terms in terms of these products of VCF W deformed tree amplitudes. Now, there is one thing that is nice about rational terms, which is the supersymmetric amplitudes don't have these rational remainders. And they have boxes, triangles, and bubbles, but they don't have these rational remainders. And for non-supersymmetric amplitudes, these rational terms for a long time were notoriously hard to extract. But it turns out that about a year and a half ago, a very clever way to calculate these terms was developed by Badger. And as I'll show you, this makes our life very easy and lets us extract a very similar formula for rational terms. Okay, so here's how this goes.
Okay.
So because supersymmetric theories have no rational terms, you know, all you need to know is the contribution of scalars, because the contribution of fermions is exactly the same up to a negative sign. Okay. So all you're interested in is the contribution of scalars to rational terms. Now, the contribution of scalars to rational terms can be extracted in this clever way as follows. So you take the scalar that's propagating in the loop, and you assign it a fake mass. Okay. So in general, your scalar is massless, but you assign it a fake mass mu. And you calculate your box, triangle, and bubble coefficients as usual. So you just calculate them with this fake mass. Okay. And then you consider the large mass limit of these coefficients. So you look at what happens to this box, triangle, and bubble coefficient at large mass. And then in around an expansion of mu equal to infinity, you look at the mu to the 4 term in the box coefficient, the mu square term in the bubble coefficient, the mu square term in the triangle, and the mu square term in the bubble coefficient. And the key thing for us, I'm not giving you more details of this, these hashes are subcoefficients that are not important for us, but the key thing, the key physical thing, is this large mass bit. Okay, so once again, you get these rational terms from products of tree amplitudes, which are deformed by some mass, this time by giving them a fake mass, but by taking this mass to be large. And it turns out that this large mass bit behaves very much like a BCFW deformation. Okay, so this again helps us simplify what happens to rational terms. Let me tell you how this happens for boxes. Okay, so if you look at boxes, the way you calculate box coefficients is by looking at the product of 4 tree amplitudes. And it turns out that if you look at how the momentum behaves at large mass, it behaves as some function of mu, but with order 1 and order 1 over mu terms, plus some order mu coefficient into some vector chi. Now, this is almost exactly a BCFW deformation. This chi is not a null vector. In a BCFW deformation, it would have been a null vector. But that's not important for us. Okay? And you can show that if you have two massive scalar particles, which are on shell, and where the momentum behaves in this way for large mass, that the tree amplitude with two scalars and many gluons, again, has exactly the same kind of behavior that it did for the BCFW case. Okay, so the term with, it's exactly the same game, where you ask, you know, how many generators can you get in this amplitude, and you find that the term with one generator comes to the mu, the term with two generators comes to the 1, the term with 3 generators comes to the 1 over mu, and so on. Okay, so now instead of having z here, let me just have mu here. And remember I said that the contribution of the box coefficient comes through the term which goes as mu to the 4 in the product of 4 tree amplitudes. Okay, so you can see when you do that, you'll obviously get a trace of t to the 4. And you can't get anything more. Okay, so you know, just from here, if you look at the product of 4 amplitudes of this kind, and you ask for the coefficient of z to the 4 here, you'll get a trace of t to the 4 and nothing else. Okay. So that's exactly what happens. You can get either a fourth order trace or a second order trace, and you can repeat this calculation for the contribution to rational terms for triangles and bubbles, and it doesn't change this result. Okay. So rational terms in gauge theories with matter are also sensitive to only a few invariants of the representation, to only a few traces, not to anything. So this is, again, something that's very surprising, and it's not something you see just by looking at Feynman diagrams or looking at the 1 PI action. You don't see these simplifications. You need these new techniques to extract these terms that will tell you that this is the case. Okay, good. So now let me just summarize for those of you, and then I'll move on to things that are slightly different. Okay, so the summary basically is that, you know, at one loop you can expand any quantum field theory amplitude in terms of these boxes, triangles, bubbles, and rational terms. Okay, and in general, the contribution of matter to triangles, bubbles, and rational terms depends on only the trace of a small number of generators of the matter representation. Okay, it's not true that the entire one loop amplitude depends on only a few generators, because the contribution of boxes doesn't. Okay, but at least for these subleading singularities, you find that the contribution depends only on a small number of generators. Okay, so I'm just going to summarize for you. Let me just summarize what I was saying. So if you look at the contribution of matter to triangles, it contributes to the 6th trace, so a trace of up to 6 generators. Okay, the contribution of supersymmetric matter to triangles contributes to a trace of up to 5 generators. The contribution of non-supersymmetric matter to bubbles contributes through a trace of up to 4 generators. The contribution of supersymmetric matter to bubbles contributes through a trace of only 2 generators. Rational terms, supersymmetric matter, there's no contribution to rational terms. And for non-supersymmetric matter, you get a contribution through this trace of 4 generators. Okay? So it's very easy to summarize entirely the contribution of matter to these subleading singularities. And it's this, and it's much, much simpler than you would naively have expected. Okay, now this leads to an interesting idea. Okay, let's say I had a theory. You know, you can think of the n equal to 4 theory also as some theory with matter in the adjoint representation. Now, let's say I had a theory where the trace of a small number of generators, you know, mimics the same trace in the adjoint, is exactly the same as the same trace in the adjoint. Okay? So since these triangles and bubbles and rational terms are only sensitive to the trace of a small number of generators, you know, this other theory that I came up with would have a simple S matrix as well. So the fact that these subleading singularities are not sensitive to the entire character of the matter representation means you can basically mimic the n equal to 4 theory. Okay? Okay, good. So now what's the condition for your S matrix to simplify? I'm going to write this up here. By the way, for all those who've been sleeping, you can wake up because now I'm just going to do group theory and you can think of how to solve these group theory constraints. Okay, good. So let me just write this condition to, okay. So I wrote this up here. Okay, so you can ask, what are the conditions for the matter representation to simplify? And it turns out the conditions are very nice. You know, there's this condition basically that the trace of some number of generators needs to mimic the trace in the adjoint. Okay. So for non-supersymmetric theories to have only boxes, what do you want? You want to mimic the trace of 4 fermions and 6 scalars, right? Up to order 6. For non-supersymmetric theories to have no bubbles, you want to mimic the contribution of 4 fermions and 6 scalars, but only up to order 4. Okay, so this P tells you what order you're going up to. Okay, and for supersymmetric theories to have only boxes, you want to mimic the contribution of 3 chiral multiplets, but up to order 5. And for them to have no bubbles, you want to again mimic the contribution of 3 adjoint multiplets, but only up to order 2. Okay, there's a contribution for scalars. Maybe I'll write it and put it up here. Okay, now for the reason, so this is the condition for a non-supersymmetric theory to have no rational terms. So this is just the condition, basically, that your theory mimics a supersymmetric theory, an n equal to 1 supersymmetric theory, because even n equal to 1 supersymmetric theories have no rational terms. So the reason there's a half here is because we count in terms of real scalars rather than complex scalars, okay? So you have, basically, what happens? You have a vial multiplet would give you, a chiral multiplet would give you 0 contribution, because this trace of RF would entirely cancel off with this, okay? But then you need something to cancel off the contribution of gluons, and that's why you need this trace of adjoint. Okay, so this is the condition that there are no rational terms, and this is just the condition that your theory will mimic the contribution of an n equal to 1 theory. Okay, good. So now all the terms are here. All these conditions are here. And for those of you who've been sleeping, you can wake up now and think of how to solve these equations. Okay, so this is something that independently of anything to do with S matrices, you can think of, can you find representations that satisfy these constraints? Okay. This is just a nice problem in group theory. So at first sight, you know, you might think that these things are impossible to solve. In fact, when we first saw them, we were like, oh, well, this means there are no next to simplest quantum field theories, because, you know, if you look at the trace of 4 generators, it can never match the trace of 4 generators in the adjoint. How can that ever be? It's not possible. And you might suspect that if you have SUN for each of these 4 generators, you could choose, you know, one of the n square generators of SUN, so you'd get order of n to the 8 equations. So you might expect that, you know, maybe there are some very special representations, maybe something in SU3 or so on, but there's definitely, you know, that in general you wouldn't expect to find some nice set of solutions to these equations. In fact, though, these equations, this is entirely wrong, these equations are much simpler than they look. And they're simpler because of the following reason. Okay, so I'm going to take a slight detour into group theory. Okay, so all of us are familiar with this quadratic index that we learned at our mother's knee, which is that if you look at trace of just 2 generators in a representation, you can expand that in terms of this Killing form and one coefficient, which is called the quadratic index. If you look at the trace of 3 generators, this is in fact 0 for everything except for SUN, but for SUN this is non-zero and this is called the anomaly, and we know about this too. Okay, this is the symmetrized trace of 3 generators. But you can keep doing this. You know, you can look at a symmetrized trace of four generators, and you can expand that out in terms of an invariant four tensor of the algebra, multiplied by some coefficient, which is called the fourth index, plus something which is the product of lower order terms, multiplied by another coefficient. And in fact, there are as many independent indices as the rank of the algebra. So to specify a representation, you know, you could specify the weights of its highest weight state, or you could specify its indices, or you could specify its Casimirs. In fact, these indices and Casimirs are just related by a factor of the dimension. Okay? So you can, if you're given a trace of many generators, you can expand it out in this way in terms of the invariant tensors of the algebra. So in fact, you don't have n to the 8 equations, but you have some very simple, very small set of equations. Okay? And that's because, you know, so you have some very small set of equations. And in fact, these equations have some nice structure. Okay? So let's say I have some arbitrary matter representation, and I expand it out in terms of irreducible representations. If I do that, these indices are linear, and what I'll get by imposing constraints of this kind are linear Diophantine equations, which are, they're just linear equations, and they're Diophantine equations because these NIs are constrained to be natural numbers, okay, involving the first few indices. Okay, so for example, this condition I showed you a couple of slides ago about mimicking the first, the trace of up to four generators of the adjoint doesn't lead to n to the 8 equations, it leads to 3 equations exactly. Okay, and these are the 3 equations. So it tells you the second index has, you have to match the second index, this I22 and I4. Okay, so they're just 3 conditions you need to solve. And all these other constraints that I have can be rewritten in terms of these indices in this form. Okay, so now you can solve them. So these indices, fortunately for us, have been studied, were studied by Okubo and Patera in the early 80s, and more recently also by Ritbergen and others. But you know, you can calculate them explicitly. These people have written down formulas, or you can just use the wild character formula and extract these indices from there. But whatever way, you can calculate them. It's not so hard to calculate them for any representation. And I said this already, and then you can see once again that you can try and solve them. The most restrictive condition is the one for triangles to vanish. In fact, the most restrictive condition is for non-supersymmetric theories to have only boxes. We don't have any solution to this. Then you can ask what are the other restrictive conditions. So you have this condition, and then you have this condition. Okay. So this is, then there's a hierarchy of conditions after this. Okay. Let me just tell you now what the solutions to this conditions are. By the way, are there any questions at this point before I tell you what the solutions to these equations are about these things I set up, these equations I set up? Larger consider Kruber theories. In a minute, actually. Okay. So larger, and there are several solutions to these conditions. If you look at the SUN theory, so there are many solutions, first of all, to these equations at large n, including, for example, our familiar friend, you know, the SUN theory with the n equal to 2 supersymmetric SUN theory with 2n fundamental hypermultiplets. Also, Kruber gauge theories, so all orbifolds of n equal to 4 satisfy these conditions, as they had to. Because at large n, these amplitudes have to coincide with the amplitudes of n equal to 4. We know that from planar equivalence. So all orbifolds satisfy these constraints that I wrote down just from planar equivalence. Okay? So this is true at large n. This is a good check, and all Kruber gauge theories satisfy this. Now, there are two examples we found where these properties persist even to all n. One of them is the following. So you look at the n equal to 2 SUN theory for n larger than 3, with a symmetric tensor hypermultiplet and some anti-symmetric tensor hypermultiplet. And this is actually an orientifold of n equal to 4, but that's not so critical for us because, you know, what is true about this theory, what's special about this theory, is that these amplitudes at all n are simple, are like the amplitudes of n equal to 4 angles. And that's something that goes beyond planar equivalence. Okay, so this is something, here's a theory where these properties persist to all n. Okay, there's another theory that we found for which we don't have a nice physical interpretation. And that's a theory based on G2, and the adjoint has dimension 14, just to give you a feel for what this is. And then you look at 3 copies of the representation 7 and 1 copy of the representation 27. Okay, this is a solution that drops out of our group theoretic constraints. And these two theories are theories that have groups of small rank, and or the SUN theory, you can have a group of any rank, which have no boxes, where amplitudes are as simple as those of the n equal to 4 theory. What did you say? The SUN with two n flavors, that's not true for any n, yes. At subleading n, that does have triangles and bubbles. Yeah, that's not as nice as n equal to 4. Okay. It's much easier to find theories without bubbles. The first set of theories you find is you look at any supersymmetric theory with vanishing one loop beta function, and that's free of bubbles at one loop. Okay. So for a supersymmetric theory, the condition to be free of bubbles at one loop is just the condition for the one loop beta function to vanish. By the way, all the other theories I spoke about in the previous transparency were also had vanishing one loop beta function. In fact, that n equal to 2 theory I told you about is probably, I mean, is almost definitely exactly conformal. Okay, so if you look at non-supersymmetric, so any supersymmetric theory with vanishing one loop beta function is free of bubbles. And you can also find non-supersymmetric examples. Let me give you one. We can find many such examples, but let me give you a couple of such. So let's say you think of the SUN theory with the same scalar content as that special n equal to 2 theory I told you about, with the scalar content of the symmetric and anti-symmetric hypermultiplet, but I replace my fermions with just 4 adjoint fermions. Okay, so this theory is not supersymmetric anymore, of course, but it also has no bubbles. It has no bubbles, yeah. And then the other example, this is not, I don't even know why I put this here, but there are other solutions you can get from your group theory constraints. For example, you look at the SU2 theory with 7 complex scalar doublets and 1 pseudo-real scalar in the representation 4. Okay, one pseudo-real scalar of spin 3/2, and that also. So there are several such solutions you can find. The point I want to make is that the condition for triangles and bubbles to vanish is extremely restrictive, and the condition for these things to vanish at all in is extremely restrictive. We found only 2 solutions. If you just want to find theories that have no bubbles, but they do have triangles, there are many, many solutions, and you can get all kinds of solutions. There's still a finite number of solutions, but you can get all kinds of solutions. No, I don't think so, because we're only looking at dual amplitudes, so I think we're fine. We're not sensitive to the other interactions. We're just sensitive to the gluon matter interactions.
So the amplitudes for other particles will not be simple.
That's right. But in this case, they'll probably not be simple. I agree. So now you can ask what about amplitudes with rational terms? So now you can find that. So it's even easier to find examples of amplitudes that don't have rational terms. And that's because if you look at any anomaly-free solution to this equation, this looks very similar to the equation I told you about, I was talking about a little time ago, that leads to a theory without rational terms. Okay? How does it lead to a theory without rational terms? This is the condition I wrote down for there to be no rational terms. And you take all the positive anion, you put that into a fermionic representation, you put that to this side. You take all the negative anion, you put that to this side. And then you add an adjoint to the fermion. Okay, now you give you a solution of this equation. And the reason you get an infinite number of solutions is because these anions can now be integers. In the previous case, these anions were constrained to be rational numbers. But the crucial thing about this condition for rational terms is that there's a minus sign. And so this leads to Diophantine equations with rational coefficients, where your variables can take values in integers, and that has an infinite number of solutions. So let me just show you some solutions for the simple cases. You can keep doing this, of course. So for example, let's say you look at the SU3 theory with the following representation of scalars and the following representation of fermions. These are the Lincoln labels for the highest weight state. This theory has some rational terms. You can systematically go through this and find an infinite class of theories that have, or you can't find, but there's an infinite class of theories with no rational terms. Okay. So people thought that only supersymmetric amplitudes were free of rational terms, but it turns out that's not the case. Lots of non-supersymmetric amplitudes are free of these rational remainders too, and you can keep going through and find more solutions. Okay, great. So let me just summarize what I learned today, and we can have some questions. Okay, so setting, we learned a lot of nice things about amplitudes, and these nice properties are explicitly very pronounced in n equal to 4 Yang-Mills and n equal to 8 supergravity, and these amplitudes in n equal to 4 and n equal to 8 see a lot of simplifications that are very non-trivial and that are difficult to see through Feynman diagrams. Okay? You can ask whether other gauge theories see such simplifications. And you can ask whether theories with less or no supersymmetry see similar simplifications. And you can ask, can you tune your matter representations in some gauge theory with matter to see these cancellations in the one-loop S matrix? The answer is yes. And the reason the answer is yes is because these subleading singularities that I told you about, these triangles and bubbles and rational terms, they depend not on the full character of the representation, but only a small number of indices of this representation. And so, the condition for these amplitudes to be simple is can be written as some linear Diophantine equations involving these indices, some hierarchical Diophantine equations, as I told you about. The condition for there to be no triangles is most restrictive, followed by no bubbles. There's an infinite set of theories with no rational terms. So these are the solutions we found. Just a quick recap. There's this n equal to 2 theory with 2n. So at large n, there are many solutions, but there are other solutions too. Two solutions with no triangles and no bubbles, and many other solutions. The other constraints, okay? So that's what we found, and then there are some open questions that naturally come about here. So what are the open questions? The first question, which is related to what Juan asked, is if you look at the n equal to 2 SUN theory with a symmetric and anti-symmetric hypermultiplet, and you look at scattering of matter particles, is that also simple? And you might expect that, or you might hope that it is. For the other theories, you probably wouldn't unless you tuned the superpotential to something very special. But in this case, you might hope that this has a simple S matrix even for matter particles. You could ask, as someone asked, whether these simplifications persist to higher loops. Okay? And then you could ask even more ambitiously, can you generalize this Grassmannian conjecture to calculate maybe the leading singularities of this theory? Of course, before you do that, you need to understand whether you can calculate the leading singularities of non-plane n equal to 4 supertriangles. But after that, the next step would be to calculate the leading singularities of that theory. And then, of course, there's a natural question, which is about whether there's a similar story for gravity. So these are all interesting questions that drop out of our analysis. And you know, that's all I have to say. We haven't.
Is there any reason why this should simplify at higher loops? It seems like this is an accident of the one loop case. In the space of all theories, you have some accidents where you get these simplifications. I don't see why it should persist at higher loops.
You could hope that. Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that question. I can't give you a good answer without doing the calculation. It might be the case that this is just an accident, or it might be the case that there's a physical significance to these things that we don't understand. And the point is, we don't, in general, understand the theory at higher loops well. So, in the absence of that, I can't give you a good answer to that question of whether there's some physical significance to these constraints and whether this thing should persist or not. So, this is just a question of looking into the dark and seeing whether being hopeful or not being hopeful. I mean, one would hope that these simplifications do persist to higher loops. Also, you might hope that, maybe these amplitudes at higher loops are not as simple as n equal to 4 superangles, but you would still expect that these are still the next two simplest quantum field theories. So you would expect, if you're going to understand n equal to 4 superangles at higher loops, and then you want to learn how to generalize this Grassmannian conjecture, for example, to other theories, you would think that the first thing to go to is this theory, not QCD, which is probably much more complicated. So this is a theory that mimics n equal to 4 angles up to one loop, and maybe it has similar properties at higher loops. There's a reason you'd be interested in this, because this gives you the natural direction in which to generalize your study. So even if it's not as nice as n equal to 4, it's still a useful study because, this might also, in these very special supersymmetric theories, often one loop properties just hold to all loops, this n equal to 2 theory is one loop beta function vanishes and it's conformal. So it might be that these simplifications persist, but even if they don't, this is still a useful study because it gives you new directions.
Any more questions? Thanks, speaker.